Coming up on the latest edition of Serie Awesome, Derby d'Italia first leg favours Juventus. There is unrest in the capital as Fonseca and Dzeko feud. Milan bounce back, but Zlatan misses another penalty. And are Gattuso's days numbered? What did the panel make of Lazio's win over Atalanta 2? It's all coming up in the latest edition. Welcome into the show. Nikki Bandini, Mina Rizzucchi, Matteo Bonetti and myself, Kay Murray, are with you. Just before we get into it, before we came on air today, we were actually talking about the fact that we all made such a point of Kevin Lasagna's last name being Lasagna that we actually missed that it was a very anglicised first name in Kevin. And Nikki gave us the revelation that his sister is actually called...
Sharon. I thought everyone knew this. Sharon Lasagna.
Really Shazza Lasagna, tongue,
as we just...
Shazza Lasagna.
I mean, that is knowledge, oh, though, Sharon. As well, that yeah. Nikki knew that Kevin Lasagna's sister was Sharon.
Yes, exactly.
Serie A knowledge. Brilliant stuff. And let's get started, shall we, with the Derby d'Italia, Coppa Italia semi-final. It was the first leg between Inter and Juve. What are your thoughts on what we saw in this one, Nikki?
Again, sort of always worth... sort of quickly pointing out at the start that these weren't the two strongest teams these teams have. We didn't see Lukaku, we didn't see Hakimi for Inter, we didn't see Bonucci, we didn't see a bunch of players in this game. But I felt like it was still in the same mould as 5 minutes ago. We were talking about that game between Inter and Milan and perhaps having thought going into it, look, it's the Coppa Italia, it's not the biggest game on the calendar, the focus is going to be elsewhere. When you get these teams on the pitch together, it matters. It just does, even if you are switching out some of those players. And I think it felt like a significant win for Juventus coming so soon after losing to Inter to be able to come and flip that result on its head. And certainly in terms of winning the Coppa Italia, it's a big leg up because now you've got the home leg to seal the deal. But it was an odd game for me, honestly. I thought that Inter started really well. Then Ashley Young gives away a completely unnecessary penalty. And then you get this mix up between Bastoni and Handanovic, which gives up another really unnecessary goal. And after that, that was sort of the game was set. Juventus played better for a time. Then Inter got on top and really had the chances that they should have got at least back to 2-2. But it was just a weird game because it was so defined by two pretty serious blunders by Inter. I suppose you could say it was defined by three because the goal that Inter scored, Buffon had under himself, that I don't know quite what to take from it other than that. Keep saying this over and over again. This is my stuck record this season. Yes, not having Lukaku makes it harder. You're not as good up front. Definitely Inter were missing him. But if you give up two goals, you don't need to give up every game. That's the first problem you have to fix. And that's kind of what Inter did today.
Nikki, I agree with much of what you said. Like you said, the best players weren't on the pitch. But the thing is that, you know, Hakimi and Lukaku not being on the pitch because of suspension. But I think otherwise, it looked like Conte really wanted to win this match because he put on his best players. You know, the likes of De Rai, Skriniar, Barella, everyone really started, including Vidal, you know. Eriksen was tried because it was Benevento, right? But it's like when the game is against Juventus, then he was going to go with his usual warriors, which means Vidal. For Juventus, however, there were a lot of changes because I think on a usual level, you wouldn't expect to see De Ligt and Demiral as your starting centre-backs, especially the way that Chiellini has been playing and how important he has been since he's come back. And then when you look at the fact that it's Bernardeschi up top, it's Kulusevski, there was no centre-forward there, which really bothered me. There's no Chiesa there. There's Rabiot. Rabiot really... He hurts me. I don't think he's a bad player. I definitely don't. And I do think he's improved a lot from last season, but I'm not entirely sure what he adds to this. You know, he's sort of just a physical being that goes up and down and shuttles across and offers a passing outlet, but he doesn't have a particular skill, like, you know, like goes into the box like McKennie or controls the ball like Arthur, or what's the point? I don't understand. But anyway, yeah, point is that there was a lot of changes for Juventus, less so for Inter. And I think that this is where we see, you know, it seemed like in the second half, Inter tried to do what Juventus did, you know, the high press and all of that. But it's amazing how much you just know this inside. They need a lot of determination, a lot of desire. They have to win every ball. They have to have Lukaku. They have to have space. And that's when they win. You take away three of those things and you render them rather useless, to be honest. I know they were mistakes. And what bothered me afterwards is that Antonio Conte came out and said that they were much, much, much better. And I just thought you could say that they were on par, but in no way can I ever think to myself that this winter performance was deserving of many goals. And Nikki, you also said something along the lines of they should have at least gotten an equaliser. Does that mean that you think that they should have gotten perhaps a winner as well?
I can't remember what I said now. I felt like a draw would have been a pretty fair result for this game. I thought that,
yeah, I agree with
certainly
that.
Buffon made one really exceptional stop in the second half, which offset the mistake maybe that he'd made before. I felt like Inter had enough pressure to win. If the point you're getting at is did they create the chances? I mean, it's a fair question. They didn't create that many golden chances. I think it was sort of my feeling that the draw reflected the balance of play comes a bit from that and a bit from the fact that they gave those goals away so cheaply. I mean, the second one was just a straightforward miscommunication between Bastoni and Handanovic, but both of them have made such bad decisions in that moment. You see Bastoni trying to tell Handanovic to hold back, and maybe Handanovic should. Perhaps Handanovic feels in that moment, well, I've got seniority here. I'm making the call. I'm going for that ball. And in that case, maybe Bastoni should not do what he does. But in the end, when you get to that last moment of there's an attacker right there, you just put it out of play.
Yeah, not just any attacker, Cristiano Ronaldo.
Exactly.
So this is the decline now that we've seen for Samir Handanovic, which isn't just a blip. This has gone on now for the last year, I'd say, last 12 months, where he hasn't made the saves routinely that he normally does. He's made mistakes that we've just never really seen from Handanovic throughout his Inter career. This was long time one of the best goalkeepers in Serie A, someone that was always dependable, that really would save Inter a lot of points. And of course, Inter should be going all out on these games. Let me check my notes. Yeah, nope, still no European football this season. That means you have the Scudetto and the Coppa Italia. You can still win two trophies. You don't have the excuse of the midweek games. And by the way, I'm surprised no one mentioned it yet. Conte's comments after the match about...
Yeah, Mina mentioned it.
But she didn't go into it the way that I thought Mina would. Normally, Mina sticks in the knife. He's going at the financial situation, saying that the team's been frozen since August. What does that have to do with this game? I thought Inter actually had some really good stretches in this game. And you're going at the board once again when this team bent over and backwards to give you all the players that you wanted, which, by the way, some of them, the experienced players that you wanted, haven't exactly worked out, like Alexander Kolarov and Arturo Vidal's really been hit or miss, but they got you Romelu Lukaku, which, by the way, your old club couldn't even get you in the Premier League with all the TV rights money. So the excuses are coming back. I felt like we had finally moved past the chapter of Conte all the time, moving past we played this Wednesday game, we had 24 hours less of practice than this team, all the stuff that we heard last season, but now it's coming back. What is the transfer market and the financial situation, which, by the way, Inter have really assembled a very good team top to bottom. What does that have to do with this game?
But it hasn't been a bad run for Inter of late to be criticizing them now.
Exactly.
And obviously, there was a Coppa Italia win over Milan on the way to this. There was a 4-0 win over Benevento just before this game.
Yes, Benevento, I know
you're going to say that.
No. Of course. And it wasn't a Pazza Inter performance. It was actually a calm match where you didn't have half the technical staff thrown out fighting with referees in the tunnel. Where you didn't have Arturo Vidal lunging into someone. It was an actual calm, normal performance that you'd expect from a team that's as good as Inter. And I think that's the frustrating thing, is like you hear the comments from Conte in press conferences and you think that Inter, not even the top four, Inter are going to be neck and neck
but
with Milan.
But should we not be used to those Antonio Conte comments
If you removed all the performances on the pitch and you just looked at the comments week to week, you'd think that Inter are an absolute mess, disarray, completely underachieving. They might go on and win the Scudetto. And I can't remember for the life of me a team that has had so much criticism for the manager, so much negative energy swirling. Every time there's talk, you just feel this heaviness, this pressure. And it's like, you guys are right there for the Scudetto? Like, this is the first time in more than a decade that Inter are ahead of Juve. Like, what am I missing?
This is what annoys me a lot, is when you have, you know, coaches like Fonseca, like Gattuso, like Pirlo after the match between the two, who are constantly like, should they be in this job? And you're thinking, wait, hold on a second, yeah? For one thing, Pioli didn't know he had the job till like July. So he has been working, you know, knowing the fact that he could easily be replaced by Ranić. Fonseca's just come up from Shakhtar with a squad that continues to change, you know, sporting director, change of ownership, everything. Gattuso, I mean, there are just so many problems for these different coaches. But Conte is one of the few in which you can say there's consistency there. Every, you know, they have tried to give him all the players that he's wanted as well. And when you look at this team, I cannot really understand what he's angry about, because Juventus are playing with Bernardeschi up top. Yeah, it's not like they're sitting there throwing you. I mean, they have Ronaldo, granted, you know, but we're still talking about a guy that arrived from Sassuolo and Demiral, you know, Danilo, who was a joke for most of the last few seasons that he's been playing football. We're not saying, you know, like you need to dominate every game, but I think this puts the Derby d'Italia in the actual Serie A. It sort of exposes a few things. What would have happened had Juventus had Alexandro and Juan Cuadrado in that game? You know, Lukaku, you cannot be so dependent on these two players to offer you so much, or there's little going forward. I'm not saying that they didn't create chances. I'm saying that with the benefits that they have and the blessings that they do have, which is a consistency, which is the fact that he's on 12 million because he's the most experienced and the best coach in Serie A, let's be honest. He's won a lot in his career. You ask for a little bit more. You know, when you look at teams that are overachieving right now, Roma's in third, you talk about Milan in first, you know, we can criticize Juventus and we can criticize Inter because they're not overachieving, because they have a lot of things in their arsenal and it's not being used wisely. This is a first team that was put out, basically missing two players. And we sit there and we're talking about Gattuso, who, you know, who's lost half his players for most of the time, when Pioli is challenging, really challenging Juventus with basically like the skeleton of a team. Then you do turn around and say, really? Well, what is it you want? Like, Messi, what do you need on this bench? Because you pretty much have a perfect squad. And when it's not perfect, like Ashley Young, who made the error, it's because these are your choices. So you need to also accept that. And Arturo Vidal, again, did you see that? He comes off and he says it's always the number 22 that comes off. Who do you think you are? you have to accept the choices. Ronaldo was taken off too. You know, not that Ronaldo's ever taken off, but
and let's just say, sorry, Mina, I'll let you finish. But let's just say that if Stefano Sensi was 100% healthy and played like the player that we saw the first 2 months before all the injuries, Vidal wouldn't be a starter. I mean, you'd look at that midfield and you say, right, Barella, Brozovic, and Sensi. At least that's what I would go with.
Yeah, definitely. I would go with that.
Just to say, Ronaldo definitely didn't look happy about coming off either. Noticed as a distinctly, and worth bringing that up in the context of this game, Ronaldo hadn't done very well against Inter in the games he'd played against them so far. So a good thing for Juventus for him to get that. I'm not really running counter to your overall thought, but I do think it's worth sort of just adding the nuance that I don't think Conte is just talking about transfer budget when he talks about what's going on with ownership. What's going on with ownership is something very specific. It's something that several foreign-owned Chinese businesses are going through at the moment, where there seems to be this real lockdown on the ability to operate. I think that it's not even so much just about who's coming in. I think that, frankly, if it was up to Conte, Ericsson, and that's a whole separate story, would have gone out this January. And whether or not that's a good thing, we can discuss, but Inter are in a weird freeze at the moment, and that is not a comfortable place for any football club to be, regardless of the specifics of who you have in your squad.
Well, they tried to do the swap between Alexis Sanchez and Edin Dzeko, but the disparity in salaries is what prevented that. They tried to offload Christian Eriksen, but the 7.5 million euro net a season that teams were like, you know what, in this climate, we're not taking that on unless Inter pay a percentage of that. Inter didn't. They just wanted to offload him and have a team swallow that. I think around £350,000 is what the English papers were saying when it was Tottenham that were maybe interested in bringing him back. So they have to make it work with Eriksen. But in the end, even if they have a freeze, this is still maybe the deepest team along with Juventus. Certainly Juve and Inter have by far the best.
I will push back a little bit on that idea, because Juventus' wage bill is still substantially bigger. And I think this was a game where you saw that. Well, you 8 saw million the
higher. The net spend over the last 5 years by Inter has been higher than that of Juve's.
And the wage budget, not transfer
wage budget, is 80 million. And this is a team that reached
80 million is a lot, Mina. That's
no, I don't think so. I don't think at the grand scheme of things, amount. When you look at the facts between Inter and the rest,
that's twice what most teams in Serie A even spend. If we're but talking about
Juventus, have also wasted so much money with these free transfers, where like Rabiot and Ramsey are making an obscene amount of money.
There we go. That's why I'm not somebody who likes to look at that. Whereas net spend, Inter is higher.
Well, that's. Yeah, then you're not making a fair comparison at that point, because what you're saying is that Juventus get to write off their poor decisions, whereas Inter don't.
No, I think both of them should be criticised, and I said that at the top. I'm saying to you that you can't complain about these things, because then you should be above Milan.
I'm not complaining because
right?
I don't have a horse in the race. No, I just think that they are different. No, they're
Mickey,
not
I'm
the
not talking
same.
About you. I'm talking about, obviously, when we're starting to talk about wages, these things irritate me, because an Atalanta shouldn't be where they are, and then Milan shouldn't be the first
and it's
either.
Amazing.
So you can't only compare it to Juventus, because Juventus should be winning everything, and that's why they should be criticised. But Inter's second, so they should also be criticised. Yeah. That's it. They're the only two squads with a massive wage bill or a massive whatever it is. And while there is a difference between them, I don't think that you can sit there and say, yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, on the pitch, whoever's playing, we're not asking you to do amazing things, but we're asking you to maybe not fall out of Europe and then complain about the team not supporting you. At the end of the day, they've bought you players, and you're right, but Ivan Juric is playing with a bunch of team players that are all on loan most of the time, and he's still succeeding. Fonseca is succeeding with a team that continues to fall apart, you know, where Zaniolo's off and Kluivert's gone and all these different players have gone and new ones arrived and whatever is happening, you know, but he makes it work. And so I'm not asking you to win the Champions League, because I think that's too much to ask for you, you know, and I think that is too much to ask. I don't even ask that but I ask for a little bit less complaining. That's all.
While we are with you, Mina, any thoughts on Juve's 2-0 win over Sampdoria, Chiesa and Ramsey on the score sheet there?
It's interesting, because I thought that was what was irritating about this match, was that for some reason Ranieri looked very scared to face Juventus, and he went with a very defensive option and played with a lot of men at the back. And I think that what happened is you lost control of your midfield. Pirlo's made these mistakes before. And when you lose control of your midfield, then you just allow yourself to be attacked vertically by Juventus. And that's what they did. I thought this was a game in which they really showed that when they are at their best, they're one of the best sides to watch, but that they cannot contain or maintain that brilliance over a whole 90 minutes. And that is where we are. But of course, this is a strange year in which I can't ask any team to maintain that concentration and that ability for 90 minutes, because everyone's playing every 3 days. So,
Mina, as much as Juve was criticized, and rightfully so, in the first half of the season, and Andrea Pirlo struggling to figure out what his best lineup is, 5 games now since that 2-0 loss to Inter, only one goal conceded. They've won every single one. So it feels to me like this is truly the turning point that I think we hinted about on this podcast, that it was always going to take a half a season for Pirlo to get his bearings. He'd never even coached his son's 5-a-side team, and now he's coming in and he's managing a team that is expected to win everything that they're in. And we saw the struggles early on with the different formations, the two central midfielders and three. Then you had like Chiesa and Kulusevski on the same side. It was just a mess from week to week. But the good news for Juventini listening on is Pirlo now has realized, A, what the best formation is. B, I think what the best personnel is, especially in the midfield, this resurgence and evolution of Weston McKennie as a footballer, Federico Chiesa showing that he isn't just another Bernardeschi, another Fiorentino winger who's young, coming in for a lot of money, that's going to be inconsistent or sit on the bench. He's really upped his game playing, in his words, a team that when Juve come calling, you have to answer. And he has also answered that call in terms of the play that we've seen from him on the pitch. I've been so impressed with Chiesa. You know, he wasn't a finished footballer at Fiorentina. He was someone that his final decision was lacking. He wasn't clinical. He had a lot of chances on goal and he didn't score much. And I thought he had pretty poor balance, where he'd go down very easily when there was contact. And we've seen, I'd say, a much more dynamic version of Chiesa, someone who is putting away those chances, is creating his own shots, and is working so hard for the team. And he is, to me right now, the lock right next to Alvaro Morata and Cristiano Ronaldo, given that those are probably the two other options that Pirlo would go with. But we're seeing more clarity now, I think, is my overall point from Juve and Pirlo.
I do think that Pirlo is very good at learning from his mistakes. So every time he's had a bit of a slap in the face, whether that has been Barcelona, whether it's been Inter, he has sort of picked himself yourself up and try to resolve the problems, you know, whether that be defensively or offensively, or like you said, now in the midfield, he's trying to find that rhythm. I also think on a tactical level, you can see small improvements. Like, for example, in the Coppa Italia, every time they try to play it out from the back, you notice that the centre-backs go really out wide. So if they do lose the ball, they lose it in the wide areas and not centering. And the one time they made that mistake, Rabiot nearly gave away the ball, nearly gave away the goal. So there are little things that you can see, little tweaks that they've obviously learned from in the past that they're trying to integrate. What worries me for this side is that I yesterday had written on Twitter along the lines of, I'm not sure why Keane is coming on now. And I actually spoke to somebody, you know, who's a journalist who was at the stadium and who said, if you are here in, you know, in the actual stadium, you can see how effective he is at rallying the troops and how effective he was against Sampdoria. And it's not just shouting or yelling at these guys or saying anything. It's about, guys, we only have 2 minutes. Just give it your all. Or, well done, Bernardeschi, that was an amazing pass. Or, oh my God, that was a delightful goal. Go, McKennie, go. He is such a leader on the pitch. And it's not surprising that they've won him on in the final few minutes just to make sure that they can preserve that win. That made a lot more sense to me after I found that out. And it was a little bit like I made this point as well about Buffon and how he was shouting at Portanova, like, give it everything, give it your all. Having those types of leaders on the pitch makes a difference. Sadly, these two leaders, we're talking about players that are well over 35 and I'm not sure if we can really last anymore in Juventus. But that kind of what is what you need. And I don't think that they, you know, they didn't have Chiellini, they don't have Buffon all the time, and that makes a difference. I would like to hear Ronaldo being a lot more vocal as well. But these are the things that are the differences. You know, Lukaku makes that difference for Inter. So on a psychological level, he's that leader as well. But for teams that sometimes fall apart, like your Napoli's, I wonder whether the difference is just having somebody like Chiellini who is going to be there to just, so it's not just a voice on the bench like Conte, but someone on the pitch who was also there to rally you on.
Just before we do move on, the next games are worth mentioning for both Juve and Inter. So Juve are facing Roma, and we'll be talking about them very soon. And on Friday, it's Fiorentina against Inter. That calendar's getting pretty packed, isn't it, Nikki?
Yeah, actually, it was the one other thing I really wanted to say about this Coppa Italia game. It's ridiculous that they're playing two-legged semi-finals this year. I know that's the normal setup. I'm sure that there are broadcast rights holders who would prefer not to lose a game. But football as a whole has absolutely refused this past year to step back and acknowledge the reality of what's going on in the world. The fact that you have constricted 1.5 seasons into like less than a full season's worth of time. And just at some point, you have to let the fact that footballers are humans who need a break come into your considerations. And I think you could have made this a one-legged tie. It would have been brilliant. It would have been great drama. Nothing would have been lost in a competitive sense. And making these teams play an extra game is just unnecessary, in my opinion.
Well, I think you mentioned it. You answered your own question. It's all about the TV rights, I think. It's all about the money that's involved in the game. And it is an extra game and an extra great game as well. Because if you get the chance to have two Juve-Inter ties, you know that that's going to draw a lot of viewers. That's a lot of advertising money, especially with no one going to the stadiums and filling the tickets. That you need that sort of TV revenue, and a lot of the sponsors, I'm sure as well, probably have a pretty big say in this, as is always the case.
But you obviously have to look after your product as well. You have to look after
I agree. I 100% agree with you.
But when the calendar was drawn up, I mean, obviously, I'm sure that you can change it. But when it was drawn up, I think maybe they thought that this whole thing would be over and then people would be back in the stadiums by November so we can resume service as normal. And then it's kind of like, oh, we might be here for the next 6 years. So, I wonder whether it was just a case of, okay, let's not just change it. Let's just leave it the way it is and keep it.
Maybe. But speaking of footballers being human, Zlatan missed another penalty for Milan. And I would like to ask a question here because it was a few weeks back, maybe a few months back now. Zlatan has been known for missing penalties this season. And after one of his misses, he said, he joked, it seems, it definitely was a joke, that he was going to let Frank Kessie take the penalties from now on. Now, they have held on to top spot. They did beat Bologna 2-1. But is this something that needs revisiting, Matteo?
It reminds me so much of when Cristiano Ronaldo joined Juventus, and Juventus just happened to have the best free kick taker in Serie A, Miralem Pjanic, who that was his best attribute. You knew that when he was outside the box and there was a set piece, it was like a penalty for him. He just always put it into the top corner. He was so damn dangerous from the dead ball just outside the box. And what do you know? You have Cristiano Ronaldo coming in, blasting free kicks into the wall, over the crossbar. And the thing is with Ronaldo is when it goes in, it's usually beautiful, right? Because he strikes it dead on, the ball kind of swerves in the air, doesn't have bend, and he hits it with so much power. But Miralem Pjanic is the much better free kick taker. This is the same situation now at Milan, where Frank Kessie is a lot more clinical for whatever reason than one of the best goal scorers that we've had in the 21st century. Zlatan Ibrahimovic has missed like almost a third of his penalties, sorry, two-thirds of his penalties this season, whereas Frank Kessie's 8 for 9. Like, it's one of those where the hierarchy shows whoever's on the pitch. Ibra makes the decisions. Ibra's top dog. If Ibra wants to take the penalty, who's going to go and pry it away from his Taekwondo black belt?
But there was a great moment because as Ibrahimovic goes to take that penalty, Sinisa Mihailovic is on the sideline shouting to Lukas Swarovski, don't worry about it. He can't hit them. Like, he's actually telling his goalkeeper this, which I love as a piece of psychological distraction, because clearly he's saying that to Skorupski, but the words are intended for Ibra. He knows that Ibrahimovic is going to hear that and it's going to get into his head. And the fact that he then misses it after that's happened. I mean, I will say, of the misses, this is one of the better ones. It was a good save, in fairness to Skorupski. But boy, it's a long way back from that, I think, for the next one. And if I'm Kessié, who goes on to score one later in the same game, I'm pushing a little bit harder next time Ibra says he wants one.
They ask Kessié, how come, you know, you didn't take the first one since Ibra seems to have given you it? And he said, well, he's a designated penalty taker. So every time there's a penalty, he decides who's going to take it, whether it be him or whether he gives it to me. And I thought that was just so, I think the way that the team rallies around Zlatan and the way that he sort of, you felt like this was a match in which he was trying really hard not to necessarily be the icon, but like try to give back because he must feel a little bit bad about what happened in the derby. So this was a game in which he was like, okay, I'm going to take the penalty because I want to score and then you'll all love me again. And then, okay, I didn't do that. So never mind. I'll just work really hard for the rest of the game. And he was really, really good. And it should be worth noting that Sinisa Mihailovic and him are really good friends. So it was all done in jest.
Aside from Ibrahimovic, though, I think the great news for Milan is that they weathered the storm of all the injuries and COVID cases. I don't think they'll ever have such a depleted squad as they had in the last 2 months. And the great news is that Ismail Benacer, who hadn't played since November, came into this game. And Benacer, to me, is one of the top three guys of this team in terms of really giving them their identity in the best stretch in 2020. Benacer looked like genuinely one of the best deep-lying playmakers in Europe at times. I mean, he was flawless, shockingly good sometimes. So great news for Milan. They're getting back some of their players. And Fikayo Tomori, what a story, right?
Yeah.
He joins Milan the day after. He's playing in the Derby della Madonnina. He's coming in for an injured Simon Kjaer. And then he starts. I think we've seen some very good signs from Tomori. He had one very dangerous clearance. But other than that, I've really liked his aggression, his pace. He definitely has attributes that you can see why Paolo Maldini said that they've been scouting him since last summer.
There's one other point to bring up on the penalties before we leave that completely, which I just think is... it has to be raised. Both penalties to me this weekend, correct decisions, no disputing them. But Milan have now had 14 penalties this season, and the next highest number that any team in Serie A has is 5. I mean, that I know you hate stats, Matteo, but that is an extraordinary statistic.
So have you seen people saying, oh, there's a... Every single year, there's a different random team.
It was Lazio last season.
And for all the rigore, you know, the rigore per la Juve, whatever, that you see on social media, I'm not saying I buy into it, but they actually have not been the top team in penalties, I think, in the entire course of the 9 consecutive Scudetti, which is a bit strange, right? Because normally there is a little bit of a correlation between number of penalties and teams that have success, because with success comes more chances in the box, more chances for a penalty. So I found that interesting. But every single season, there was a different team. Like last season, it was Lazio getting all the penalties. 2 years before, it was someone else. Now it's Milan. I have no life, so I went back and I re-looked at all the penalties. And I saw one that is genuinely, genuinely controversial. That was the one against Roma, which was a classic makeup call. And in a game where Giacomelli, the referee, was so atrocious that he ended up getting banned for longer than a month. It's not Milan's fault that Sumaro in this game did a double handball with both his arms extended. Like, what's the referee going to say? Oh, no, Milan, you know what? Top of the penalty standings. I can't give that one, even though it was a clear bang on handball. In the end, it's not Milan's fault that the teams don't know what they're doing inside the box, that they're committing these ridiculous fouls or ridiculous handballs.
I think that sometimes when people make all these judgments on why you get certain things, I think you just have to look at the attacking play. Like, and I was actually judging, starting with this, I was looking at, for example, why Inter get so many own goals, you know, and it's obviously a product of the way that they play. The way that Milan play offensively is so unpredictable a lot of the times, and there is so much movement that you have to watch out for, that I understand these types of why they get so many penalties. Whereas most of the time, for example, when you look at Juventus, you're just hoping someone's in the box because everyone seems to be outside of it. So that's one thing. With Inter, they put physical pressure on a lot of these centre-backs, and so what ends up happening a lot of the time is that they get so nervous they end up putting it into the back of their own net, like happened over this weekend as well, or it's, you know, ricochets or whatever it is. But it's interesting because I feel like people get really hard on and go down on a team, but having been a fan of Juventus for so long, and they do get a lot of penalties, I was just like, sometimes we just deserve them.
It could be the case. Something we must talk about with Milan now, and I don't know if it's been blown out of proportion, if it's more agent talk, but the Donnarumma contract concerns do continue. The goalkeeper is said to want 10 million euro a season to renew. Milan are offering 7 million euro plus bonuses. Mino Raiola, his agent, has reportedly continued to ask for that 10 million figure, while the Rossoneri have actually had to stretch to offer that 7 million plus bonuses. So Matteo, I see you rolling your eyes. Are there any concerns that he will leave?
I feel really bad because the last time this happened with Mino Raiola, let's not forget that a few years ago, Donnarumma's hardest period as a Milan player was right after these contract talks, when the Milan fans seemingly turned on him. They called him Donnarumma. They were saying that all he wanted was the money, that he got this big fat renewal. That was by far, and I've seen every single game of Donnarumma since he was 16, that was the most difficult period for Donnarumma. It affected his play. I don't want another salary story dragged down to the media and then the Milan fans start turning on him. Donnarumma is already top three goalkeeper worldwide. He is someone that keeps getting better. The only weakness he had in the past was his distribution. He's gotten better and better to the point where he's actually very good with his feet. He's good in the air. He has incredible world-class reflexes. He's great on one-on-ones. He is the complete keeper, and he's played five full seasons, and he's only 21 years old. I don't remember the last time I even said those words. He could go on, Kay, to have the most caps in history of football. He could set every single record if he wanted. I don't remember the last time a player at 16 was playing 38 games a season.
I feel like there's an if, though, that's 40. Coming. He could go on to do this if he stays at Milan? Or is it right for him to be looking elsewhere?
Milan needs to make it a priority. Donnarumma is as important as any other player on that team. No. They need to find a way, especially now, assuming they go into the Champions League, you have a little bit more money to play with, even though COVID is tough times, but still, they haven't had Champions League in 7 years. He is the number one priority. I don't know
if 10 million sounds
ridiculous, but...
Sorry. He's not as important as any other member of the team. He's the most important member of the team. I'd rather lose Zlatan.
Yeah, you can make that case.
And I don't think that we should, as in when that, you know, when everything came out about Messi's contract, about how much Barcelona is paying and they're being driven into the ground because of it, a lot of fans turned around and said, if anything, it's cheap because we got to watch one of the greatest players, if not the greatest player of all time, playing football. So whatever he asks for, he deserves. And I'm going to say something here because If there was Donnarumma, they wouldn't have won against Bologna, to be frank. Yeah, I mean, maybe if Bologna had a centre forward, that would have been something. But at the end of the day, this guy has single-handedly won matches for them. He is so important. If Inter had Donnarumma, they'd be winning the league and comfortably, to be quite honest. If Juventus had, I mean, Juventus have a very good goalkeepers in general, but Donnarumma is the difference. He is the difference maker at the top. Milan are where they are largely because they feel safe at the back because of him. It's why Tomori can settle in and feel safe as well. It's why, you know, Kjaer can come in and be this splendid player. I'm not saying that these guys aren't good on their own, but there is a psychological benefit to having someone that you feel safe. It's the way that Juventus feel about Ronaldo. It's the way that Inter feel when they have Lukaku. Milan feel when they have Donnarumma, there's a wall in the back. So when Calabria can go forward and when Teo can go forward or whatever it is, you know that you have a back there. So for me, 10 million is quite cheap, to be honest. And I'd rather sell my whole team if it means I can keep Donnarumma.
I think just to approach this from the other side for a second, I would love to see Donnarumma stay at Milan. I think that it would be very possibly the best place he can be. I think he's developing great there. I think actually there was a little bit at the beginning of people wanting him to be better than he was right away. And now he really is that good. He's got better over the time he's been there. But Mino Raiola, gonna Mino Raiola, if you know what I mean. He's spent his whole time in top level football getting more and more money for his clients and getting more and more money, of course, because this is an agent's job, for himself. And it's always going to be a constant chase as long as he's his agent, in my opinion. There's always going to be a new figure. There's always going to be the next contract to work towards. And that is why with Raiola's clients, if you look at his high profile clients, they don't tend to stay in one place. They do tend to keep moving because that is how you maximize as a purely financial transaction. That is how you maximize your value, is by making those moves, getting those signing bonuses, always finding the highest bidder. I hope, I really hope, and I'm saying this not just for Italian football, for as you guys have been talking about Milan's potential, but I think for Donnarumma's potential, I hope they can work it out and keep him there, because I think he's developing great at Milan. But my worry is the Mino Raiola train is hard to kind of keep up with sometimes.
Well, next up for Mina.
Oh, I was going to say, if Dybala can ask for 15 million, then Donnarumma can ask for 10, and I don't want to hear a fan complain about it.
So. I was waiting for a Dybala comment. Next up for Milan, it is Crotone this weekend, but we will move on because there is a lot to talk about in Rome. Now, it's been a weird week in the capital. We follow on from Roma's derby loss to Lazio. Then they lost to Spezia in the cup. Then they had that crazy win over Spezia in the league. Then they scored 3 goals in 9 first half minutes for that 3-1 win over Hellas Verona. And we will get to the games in a minute if we need to. But the big topic has been Fonseca against Dzeko. There was a fight between the two of them, not a physical bust up, at least that's not what's been said. And apparently they've been at odds since last August Europa League exit to Sevilla. And the fact that Fonseca was willing to offload Dzeko didn't help matters. So it reached boiling point after the cup catastrophe. Dzeko is then left out of the squad, apparently due to a disciplinary situation. Then the word has come that Fonseca has forgiven his captain, who returned to train with the rest of the group on Tuesday morning, could be back in the squad against Juventus at the weekend. His 10 days out was officially due to injury and not a disciplinary issue. And so the word is that Dzeko could be called up, but Borja Mayoral could actually start. So is this solved, or is there a fear it may resurface, Mina?
I don't think it was solved when you brought up Sevilla. I think that's when the problem started. I think that they had been brewing for some time. I think Dzeko is an ambitious player and he wants certain things. He came out and spoke in a way that I didn't think was very nice. I understand your frustration, but I always think that you should try to keep it sort of in-house if you can with your coach. But then it looked like it was okay over the summer. And at the end of the day, is no one came for Dzeko. And at the end of the day, it is 7.5 million. So it's not like Fonseca said, get rid of him. I just don't think he has that much power to keep him if he wanted to. Look, I don't think this is going to resolve itself, but there's nobody in, you know, no one came for Dzeko. It didn't happen for him. His salary is very high and he might leave in the summer. But for the moment that he's there, there's a lot of work that he can do. Roma are in third. And frankly speaking, if I have a huge bust up between my star striker and my coach and I still manage to get 7 goals in 2 games, I'm smiling at this moment in time, you know. Roma have done incredibly well with Borja Mayoral up front. Mkhitaryan has been in inspired form. And over the weekend, they managed to get 3 goals against Ivan Juric's team that hasn't conceded 3 goals this season. That is possesses one of the best defenses in Serie A. So I find it very strange when there's any criticism aimed at Fonseca or Roma for the way that things are going. Whether or not Dzeko is going to be upset, we see this in teams all the time. But if I am an authority figure in that club, and if I am management at this point in time, I think it's always important to stand by your coach. And when you stand by your coach, the team falls in line. Otherwise, it will be a PSG situation, and I don't think that's good for anyone.
Yeah, I think this is kind of a situation that's on the clock anyway. I think that Fonseca's great success this season, there's been several, I think, several things he's done really well, but I think his greatest success has been showing that there is an attacking life to this team beyond Edin Dzeko. Because I think for the last few seasons, we've asked that question a lot of whether or not Roma can score goals without Edin Dzeko. And this season they have. And as Mina mentioned, his wage after tax is €7.5 million. It's comfortably the biggest in the squad. And at 34 years old, yes, the club would love to move him on now. And to be able to move him on and know that you can do that and still score goals is a great position to be in. I still think this summer coming up, you want to go and sign an actual striker to fill that role in the squad and give you the option. But I think that's where we are. I think this summer, both parties will be very happy for him to move on. But you have to get through these next few months together. And so this coming back together now is what you need to do. You say, look, you're here. That's where we are. And you can either be part of this or you won't. And I think Edin Dzeko is a mature enough player to understand his part in that.
So things are looking a bit better for Fonseca after that. And even when you saw some of the goals being scored, you could see that there was a camaraderie between the coach and the players. But he had been rumoured to be on the hot seat, and then the results came. And Max Allegri was said to be the front runner to replace him. So what would your thoughts be on that, Matteo?
Matteo looks like he's going to beat someone.
So let's take a step back and just think about before the season, right? If I presented to Roma and all their fans and players, you can finish top four this season, I think they would have all signed on the dotted line right away to just be fourth place, right? I didn't have Roma in my top four. I had them in the Europa League positions. I think this is the most difficult Serie A season that we've had in ages, where you have this incredible resurgence from Milan, Inter and Juve expected to battle out at the top, Napoli, Lazio, Atalanta. There's so many teams that are competing for the top four positions, and Roma have actually done quite well. Okay, they haven't played well against the very top sides in Serie A, but they've gotten the job done and then some, really producing some magnificent offensive performances. But I feel like it's the games that we saw against Lazio and against some of the other top teams that just left a little bit of a sour taste. The fact that in the first match of the season, they had to make an administration error, which caused them to forfeit against Hellas Verona. And you think, just like Inter, this reminds me of the Conte situation. You feel like listening to these headlines that Roma are like in ninth place, but they're in a great position to finish in the top four. This is a side that in the end, I feel is so well oiled under Fonseca. And it is, in my mind, blasphemy to even have this coaching rumor, given that it was Ibu Di Francesco just got extended and Cagliari is near the bottom of the table. Like, what is going on? What am I missing? Honestly, what am I missing with Paulo Fonseca? Paulo Fonseca has done a very good job at Roma.
And there are some new signings to talk about, yes, as well. Stefan El Shaarawy back.
Huge.
Brian Reynolds is there too. But I want to stick with the Stefan El Shaarawy point. Yes. Got anything to say about this, Mina?
No, I'm not his biggest fan, but the guy is so determined to come back. So any offensive weapon. Sorry, I know that this is a question about Stefan Oshawara, but can I just ask something? I understand when fans want a lot from their team. I always get fans and their demand for ambition because that's who I am. But if you're management and you're seriously thinking of replacing Fonseca, I really want to turn around and say, who do you guys think you are at this point?
Exactly. You know? How are you going to sleep at night if that happens?
Yeah, exactly. Who do you think you are that you should be doing better than Inter, who spent all this money and have a top coach, you know? Put your money where your mouth is. Don't get a guy from Shakhtar. Go get Carlo Ancelotti and then demand that he wins everything, you know. It's unbelievable. You got a great coach, a team that has fallen apart and reconstructed millions of times. You know, I'm glad they bought Stefan Oshawara. It was going to solve your problems at the same time. You should be thankful you're in third place. You're ahead of Juventus, for goodness sakes.
Any other coach
is disgusting, frankly.
I put Stefan Oshawara in that same group of Alexander Pato, just these nostalgic players.
No, he's better than Pato.
We're so... No. Pato was incredible as a teenager at Milan.
Yes. Pato has and a t-shirt Stefan, with Pato's face on it.
And Stefan El-Sharawi, let me bring you back to the 2012-2013 season when El-Sharawi was only 20 years old and he scored 14 goals in the half season before December. Then Mario Balotelli joined. He only scored two after that. Finished the season with 16 goals, even though he was on pace for 28. He was the talk of Serie A. Like, let's not forget how great Stefano Sharawi was in that six-month stretch. And then all the foot injuries happened, and he never became the player that we thought he would be. But I still have hope in Stefano Sharawi. I still feel like he's a very effective Serie A player. He can get you a dozen goals, can beat his man. I love the guy. I'm glad he's back from
I'm glad he's back, but if Zlatan didn't love him for Milan, then, you know.
Oh, and Brian Reynolds, by the way, Roma fans are going to love this kid. Super modern attacking fullback, 6'3", beats his man, quick, great final ball for 7 million, whatever it was, 7 million euro. This is a very, very great high reward, low risk signing. And I think he's going to be exactly what Roma want, assuming they keep Paulo Fonseca, given that he likes using attacking fullbacks. Brian Reynolds, I think, is going to be a very, very good bargain.
Any Roma comments from you, Nikki, as we finish this one up?
I think I already said what I was thinking about Fonseca and Dzeko. Stefan Oshawara just is one of those nostalgic names. I think when I imagine him, he's just burning past someone, and he was so fast, and that was always this defining part of his game. I'm not sure he ever moved on from that, and so I don't have vast hopes for him, but maybe Roma is the place where he feels comfortable and can do his thing.
Lazio beat Atalanta 3-1. That was the league result, because obviously they met twice in a week. So what can we take away from this result, Nikki?
I think we can take away that these two teams are very close. I think exactly as you just pointed out, they had a game just a few days before and had the opposite result. For the league game, Atalanta were missing both Gosens and Hatabur, which is both your starting wingbacks. And it makes a big difference to how Atalanta play. They are a team that wants to use that width and to get to take advantage of that. I think, my main takeaway from the league game was just that Lazio are really flying at the moment. And that cup game was a hiccup, but of all the hiccups, it was the one they could most afford. They started poorly this season in the league, but they've now won 5 in a row. They're up to 6th. And yeah, they can beat a team like Atalanta. And when they play as well as they did at the weekend, because they were really good at the weekend, they can actually make it look quite comfortable. So this top four race, which Matteo already alluded to, it is super close and intense this season. Lazio are part of it. They're the team running the most to make up ground, but I don't know. To draw with Roma, just draw on Roma, just because we just talked about them. If you put those two teams on the pitch together at the moment, I think I'd favour Lazio. So it's really tight, but Inzaghi has got things headed in the right direction at the right time to save things for the season.
My takeaway from Lazio is that Luis Alberto and Milinkovic are just two absolute studs. I have them as two of the top five central midfielders, and they play on the same team. On the other side, though, I think what we realized, and people who have been following Atalanta through this whole period under Gasperini know how important the wingbacks are. And against Lazio, the two usual wingbacks, Hans Heidegger, Robin Gosens, both out. So they had this youngster, Ruggeri, who was a teenager on the left. They had Mela, the new signing on the right. And they kind of look like a different team when they don't have the usual wingbacks out there. It's rare to think of a team that is so affected by not having that support from the wingbacks, who, unlike most other teams where fullbacks will make overlapping runs and stay near the touchline, Gasperini uses these two players to make runs into the box, and that's why Atalanta so often overload the final third. And so many times over the last few years, we see a wingback assisting the goal to the other wingback because they'll find them at the back post because they're always making these runs into the box, and they just didn't have that threat. And they really do miss a huge part of their attack, which, bizarrely enough, and as bizarre as this whole Atalanta story has been, is those wide defensive players.
I think it's a great point, and I think it's worth saying, especially, I mean, they get a lot of value from that position. Gosens is something else. Gosens, the last two seasons, I don't know that there's a better wing back in the world than how he's been playing. He's been really, really good. Actually, Atalanta have, during Gasperini's time in charge, managed to cycle through quite a few. Yeah. And some
won't
who
this
when
be
Nafzala thought,
in the beginning?
Yeah.
Castagna, who was sold.
Right. Castagna, who was, you know, not even first choice by the time he left.
Contina.
They go through, yep, Conti. They go through players, but I think Gerson's is the one, more than Hatteber, Gerson's is the one who I look at and think, no, you're a really special footballer, I think.
You know, I'm glad you bring him up because I think there's a lot that goes on sometimes. Like, it's a popularity thing. And obviously, if you play for the likes of Milan and Inter and Juventus, you'll get mentioned a lot more. We talk often about Hakimi and we talk often about Theo Hernandez, who both have and both are magnificent players, but do have things about them that need much improvement still. And then, you know, you see, I think, like, you know, when you mentioned the wide players for Atalanta, I want to mention Manuel Lazzari because I think that he is really a truly wonderful footballer. I mean, just his game against Roma, his game against Atalanta, albeit against a child, so I understand that he managed to really dominate that. But just the way that he's handled himself, I think the way that Immobile played a sacrificial game, you know, pulled back, fell a lot deeper to try to help the team. Lazio, what I like about them so much and why I think they're such a risk is, firstly, they do have the consistency. They have been able to keep their squad together for a long time under Simone Inzaghi. So there is that kind of continuity there, which they've been blessed with. But I think they're a very happy side. I mean, the way that they celebrated this was like, you know, they've just won the title. But they are a happy team where everyone is willing to do everything they can for the other. And you just feel like there are no real problems there. And especially when you look across and you see the likes of Roma and Napoli. I believe in Lazio. I believe in their dynamism. I believe in their continuity. And I believe in their tactical intelligence.
Mina, I see a producer waving us on. I just need to say this because you mentioned Manuel Lazzari. It's one of my favorite Serie A stories. This guy, in his early 20s, played for a Serie D side, fourth division Italian football, called Giacomense, who merged with Spal in the fourth division. Spal had a look at all the players on Giacomense and said, not good enough, not good enough, not good enough. We'll take that guy over there. That guy, Lazzari, you can come and join us for our quest.
Yeah, it's an amazing
He helped
story.
Bring them to Serie A. He is now a $20 million signing from Lazio and an Italian international. I mean, talk about rags to riches. That is like the Italian Jamie Vardy.
And still, I feel like despite how much he spoke about how much he had to really fight to really get to be noticed, and still, I feel half the time we just haven't even barely mentioned him on this podcast.
He's a traditional winger. He just gets down the line and crosses it in. He's not but like this inverted. He's not flashy at all. He just runs like an energizer bunny.
He is such an offensive weapon. He is so smart. He's so hardworking. He really is somebody who leaves it all out there. And I just feel like I hate that he's
very likable player. I agree. Yeah. Manuel Lazzari, legend.
So we may have another feud to keep our eye on going down in Naples, and it's between Gennaro Gattuso and Aurelio De Laurentiis. Now, we mentioned last week the Rafa Benitez rumours, but ADL is also said to have called Maurizio Sarri after Napoli's loss to Verona. Now, Napoli won the last game against Parma 2-0. And the report stated that Sarri reportedly rejected the chance to return to Napoli. Gattuso is said to have known about the whole situation, and he was asked about it after that win over Parma. He pretty much went on to say, it's okay, I have a lot of respect for him. We've always had a great relationship. He gave me Bakayoko when I asked for it, and there's a great respect there. ADL since come out and claimed fake news. But what do we think? Do we think that the Napoli president is just biding his time and waiting for the right replacement? Or can Gattuso turn this around?
I think it's a strange one because if I'm Aurelio Di Laurentiis, I've spent a lot of money. I bought in Osimhen. I've spent a lot of money over the years in creating the squad. And it's a very well-balanced squad. And there is talent in every area of the pitch. I cannot fault them at all. And yet, for some reason, they're always struggling, or have been for a while. And, you know, last season, this season, they should be a team that is at the very top. I mean, that their game is one of the best. They have one of the best defensive records in Serie A. They produce the most amount of shots on goal, and yet this is not translating to points. Now, he's gone from Real to Sarri, who couldn't win the title against what was a rampant Juventus side. Then they, you know, they tried Carlo Ancelotti, who did wonders in Champions League, perhaps not as effective in the league. They've moved on to Gattuso, and everything doesn't seem to be working. You know, it's a Coppa Italia, sure, it's this. And so I understand where De Laurentiis is coming from. He's like, I'm spending the money, I'm bringing in everything that I can, and yet it's not working. And this is the thing. It's not the coach's fault either, because on a tactical level, like I said, they create the chances, they are strong at the back. But there is something wrong with this Napoli side. The squad may be tactically balanced, but perhaps not meshed well on a personality level. There is something there in which, you know, when I spoke about Chiellini making the difference, I don't know whether it's a lack of a leader on the pitch. Lorenzo Insigne is somebody who can produce magnificent moments of football, but he's also someone that can disappear for three games in a row. And I'm not entirely sure he's the vocal person in the pitch that they need. So who does that fall to? Because, you know, at the end of the day, Callejon and Albiol and their organization and intellect helped cover a lot and mask a lot of the problems that they sometimes have. But as when you think of somebody who's out there, who's screaming, who's like, let's give everything, let's do that, it's really just Gattuso, because I don't see that on the pitch. I saw them work really hard against Parma, and I think that he's trying to sort of ugly up the team at times, because you can't always be the sensationally beautiful team that isn't efficient. But there needs to be something on the pitch, and they need Zlatan, they need, I don't know, Jose Mourinho reincarnated into the figure of a player or something, because right now what they're missing is somebody who just really fights for them, and I don't know if they have that.
I don't know. I sort of think that the tricky thing for Napoli is establishing what exactly your hopes and expectations for a given season are. I still think that what happened under Maurizio Sarri, look, it was 91 points. They came up against the Juventus team that was even better. It wasn't really, sorry, a helicopter's going over my house now, apparently, which is really distracting me. I don't know if that's coming through.
It's De Laurentiis listening to what you're saying, spying on you.
I think the Sarri chapter is its own chapter. I think it was extraordinary. And I think that even if he never does anything else in his career, I will always think that Maurizio Sarri produced something remarkable in that campaign personally. In the end, if we take a step back from where Napoli are right now, they're currently fifth. They've got a game in hand that could take them up to third. Are they doing that far off what we expect of them to be a top four team? I think they're in the picture. The thing that's confusing with them is just that some weeks they look really, really bad. They have these very confident weeks, and as I've noted before, I think they never seem to draw, but the bad weeks are really bad, and I worry that there's something that Gattuso's not quite worked out for himself about why there's such a variation in performance. And I suspect that more than the league standing, because I don't think the league standing is horrible at all, I suspect that's what's getting to De Laurentiis, is these weeks when it just looks horrible.
Yeah, there seems to be a pattern as well. Some of the poor performances the last month, especially, was when Fabian Ruiz was out and they had Dembele and Bakayoko as the holding midfielders. They just missed that dynamism from the midfield. And being without their $90 million striker, Victor Osimhen, who gelled so well at the start of the season, his movement, his link up with the likes of Insigne and Mertens and Zielinski and Fabian Ruiz, and there was just so much attacking power. And that was the ultimate tease, wasn't it? Because Napoli were so good at times in the first few months of the season, and they really looked like when they reached their high, that I'm not sure we saw that level of fluid play really from many other sides in Serie A. I mean, it was that good.
Yeah, but I mean, it was, you know, like Fabian Ruiz was on the pitch when they lost to Spezia, who had lost a man. You know, this is where I struggle, because they have really good players all over. I wouldn't mind Dembele, Bakayoko or Fabian Ruiz in my side. I would love Dries Mertens, you know. There is actually not a single player that I wouldn't want. And yet, I don't know what it is, because they're all fighters on their own, and yet collectively there is, it's the most un, I have no idea, but I'd love to be in that dressing room to try to figure out what the problem is.
No such problems for Mattia Destro, by the way, as we do wrap the show up now. Scored 2 goals in the 3-0 win over Crotone. That's 9 goals in 16 matches for him. Hopefully we'll get a chance to talk about him if he continues this in next week's show. But that is all we've got time for this week. Thank you so much for joining us. Be back again next week. Ciao for now.